Hello, and welcome to another episode of Waves of Change, a Great Lakes Now digital series focused on highlighting the diverse voices and perspectives shaping the environmental justice movement throughout the Great Lakes. I'm Anna Seisling, and I'm so grateful to you for tuning in. Joining me today is Allison Velog. Allison is a migration counter who resides in northern Michigan and has traveled all over the country for this work.
Waves of Change is brought to you by the Fred A. and Barbara M. Erb Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at DPTV, Polk Family Fund, DTE Energy Foundation, and listeners like you. Thank you.
Allison, it's really great to be in conversation with you today.
Yeah, Anna, I'm honored to be joining you.
You know, put simply, environmental justice is this idea that every person has a right to breathe clean air, to drink clean water, to live in a healthy community now and into the future. Talking about environmental justice, or rather rooting these conversations in environmental justice, is something that I try to do with every interview that's a part of Waves of Change. So I want to ask you, as a migration counter, how do you orient yourself to this idea in the work that you do with bird conservation, with migration research? Can you talk a little bit about what the intersection is there for you?
Absolutely. So I've been working with birds and bird conservation for more than a decade now, so all of my working life, essentially. And one of the really emergent themes that's come out to me through the various places that I've worked, the various populations I've been with, and just travels that have to do with birds and bird habitat and vulnerable communities, be they bird communities, plant communities, human communities, is that environmental justice stories are conservation stories. You can find environmental justice elements in every conservation story. You can find conservation aspects in every environmental justice story. Environmental justice and bird conservation are usually the same stories, just through slightly different lenses.
What is your lineage in arriving to this work, Allison?
When I was six, my dad actually asked me if I wanted to go out and look for ducks. And it was early March. I grew up in southern Michigan. When you're 6 years old and the alternative to looking for ducks or whatever activity has been suggested is a nap, you're going to want to do whatever is not a nap. And so we went out looking for ducks, and we saw a couple kinds of ducks that I previously, you know, I had thought that mallards were the only duck that we had. And I learned that the duck world was bigger than that. And from there on out, I just really became fascinated with birds. And my parents were not serious bird people. I'm not sure why they were inspired to take me birding, but they quickly realized that I was going to be way more into it than they were. And we were really fortunate to have this bird club in the area that I grew up. I grew up in Berrien County. And there was this really active bird club associated with the nature center there called the Berrien Bird Club. And they had like these bird outings every weekend morning, especially during periods of migration. And we'd all caravan out to a lake or the lake shore or a woodlot and look for specific birds. That for me really helped to continue my gaining of knowledge about birds, my appreciation for birds, and also making connections that eventually would help me start doing things on a more professional level with birds.
So prior to us recording the interview, I actually found myself wondering what to call you or how to introduce you. And I was like, is Allison a guide, a conservationist, a migration counter? Because it seems like you've done all of this work in some form or fashion. And I wonder if you can speak to maybe what this work with birds first looked like, how it took shape, if it was conservation or guiding or some combination of these things, and what got you motivated to get started doing this in a sort of more like professional capacity.
I oftentimes have a hard time choosing what label to use for myself when I'm thinking about my relationship with birds too. Like even lately, I've been like, you know, like there's this stereotype that birder is someone that's more serious and more knowledgeable than bird watcher. But I kind of like bird watcher because I really enjoy watching birds. I don't mind that maybe sounds a little more passive than birding. I think that I wanted to do things professionally with birds. It's hard to identify like when that first happened. It was a very early age, probably like 9 or 10. And I just couldn't imagine having a life that wasn't in part caring for birds and looking at birds and mostly being outside in fresh air and elements as much as I could be. And my first job, I had to go back home to be part of my graduation ceremony. So I was right out of high school, and I was the Kirtland's Warbler tour guide for Michigan Audubon and working out of Grayling, Michigan in the northern Lower Peninsula. Kirtland's Warblers are a species of bird that actually a lot of you might recognize from the license plate, because they made it onto a Michigan license plate within like the last year or two, which I think is great. At the time, the species of bird was endangered. In 2019, they were taken off the endangered species list, but then it was really controlled who could enter their habitat because they nest on the ground. They didn't want anybody just tromping around and compromising the integrity of their breeding season. So you had to go through a guide. And I was one of two guides in all of Michigan that would take people daily into the jack pine habitat, which is super cool just in and of itself, to look for these Kirtland's Warblers. And I did that for 3 years, and my tours had 100% success rate. Part of that was because at the end, I knew that I was going to be probably moving on to a different sort of job, and I wanted to keep that success rate. So I told people, I was like, you can't leave until we see them, but that never seemed to bother anybody. But yeah, the other part of that job, the Kirtland's Warbler tour leading job, was actually going out and trapping brown-headed cowbirds, which were one of the reasons the Kirtland's Warblers were put on the endangered species list. Brown-headed cowbirds are a nest parasite, which means that they lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and the cowbirds don't stay to help take care of the chicks. And the other bird will take care of the cowbird chicks, and it's usually at the extreme detriment to its own chicks. And when they started the cowbird trapping, there were just like maybe 200 or 300 Kirtland's Warblers left. It was really, really a small population. So they set up these cowbird traps, and those were run for the next few decades to remove cowbirds from the Kirtland's Warbler breeding area. And that really helped the warbler get back on the track.
It's really interesting, I think, to hear a story like that and to notice this like really quick and easy knee-jerk reaction to want to label the cowbird bad. I wonder though if you have thoughts on like after doing this work on I don't know. Is it more complex than that?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you asked that, because it's really easy to make birds like cowbirds out to be the villain. But in so many of those cases, it's because of us that the villain is in that habitat to begin with. Cowbirds were originally a bird of the Great Plains. They would follow the bison flocks around, and they needed to be more nomadic so that they could live, because they were following these bison herds. They were a part of that ecosystem, and it wasn't to the huge detriment. They weren't making any of the other birds in their ecosystem endangered. That was just a part of life there. But as the eastern forests were logged, cowbirds are not a woodland bird. As those eastern forests were logged, all of a sudden the cowbirds were finding that they could live in a habitat that had been woodland before. And so they started moving east into areas, and the species in those areas had never had to deal with anything like a cowbird before, so they were really easy prey. And I didn't like trapping and killing the cowbirds. It wasn't something that was pleasant for me, and I'm actually glad that it was such like a hands-on thing, because there was no distance between me and that process. Like, I had to think about it and actually do it and not just know that it was happening.
I know that you had some really interesting experiences when you went up and worked in Alaska for a time. I wonder if you can speak to what you were doing there, what that work looked like.
I was in my early 20s when I went to Alaska. I think I was like 21 or 22. And it had been this coveted dream job for me for quite a while. There's a place called St. Paul Island. It's in the Pribilof Islands. And if any of you have watched the show Deadliest Catch, those islands are where they process those crabs. So it's a very isolated place, and there's not really any mainland that's nearby. Alaska's like 300 miles away. Russia is a little bit further. So you're just kind of out in the middle of the Bering Sea. They are a very popular place for people who want to see birds, and there are two reasons for that. One of them is the nesting birds on the sea cliffs. The other reason that people came out there was in birding, there's this concept of listing, and a lot of people keep a life list. I definitely keep a life list. I couldn't tell you how many birds are on it, but I do know what I've seen and what I haven't seen. And when I go to a new place, I'm always excited at the prospect of seeing things that I haven't seen. I guess like the biggest stakes lists is called the ABA area list. And at the time it was the lower 48, Alaska and Canada. And any bird seen within that region was a bird that you could add to your list. And there's about 650 species of birds that are regularly found in that area. But the people that had the most on their list, they would have totals of like 800. And to get to that number of birds on your ABA area list, you would have to go to the margins of the ABA area. The Pribilof Islands, because of their location, were also one of those places that people that were really serious about adding birds to their life lists would go. And a lot of the times, the birds that they were coming to see in the Pribilofs were birds that were really common in other areas of the world. And it was just so strange to me that people would care so much about going to this little island in the Bering Sea to see birds that were really common in places of the world that were actually easier to get to than St. Paul Island. More than that, I really disliked the attitude of that sort of birding. A lot of the times you were seeing species of birds that were like so lost that they were never going to make it back to a place where they would be able to thrive. For example, a lot of these birds were from places with trees. There are no trees on St. Paul Island. The crab pot, the stacks of crab pots actually that were out for the season, that was probably the most shelter on the island. And to see the birds in the crab pots, what we would do, and like I cringe thinking about this, is we would take a piece of plastic or something else that was loud and walk down the rows of crab pots and just like scrape the sides of the crab pots to flush whatever exhausted lost bird was hiding in there. So much about that did not sit right with me. Working out there, I was there for 2 years, and working out there really, really changed the way that I felt about birds.
Hearing you talk about that experience in Alaska, Allison, it reminds me of what you said when we spoke prior to this interview, and that was to celebrate birds for their essence and not their status. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and in general, I guess, about how some of these experiences have shaped your ethics toward birding?
So my big takeaway when I left the Pribilofs was that I just like I needed to take a break from guiding, and I haven't actually done long-term guiding since then. I'll do like a trip every now and then, and at some point I'd love to have like birding classes for people who are just entering their realization that they're bird curious. But I pivoted from guiding people to see birds, to put birds on their life list, to wanting to survey migration instead. And part of that was because I would have a chance to spend long hours of observation just witnessing birds going about their natural history, their lives. And I knew that birds had so much more to offer than they have so much more to offer than just being a tick in a box or a number on a checklist. They have just incredible stories and natural histories and lives. Like they go places that I'll never go. In fact, some of the birds that I see when I'm migration counting, like that's the one time of year where I will be able to see them because they winter in places where we can't really go. And then they nest in the Arctic where we also have a really hard time going. So I'm fortunate for that proximity that they pass just like the Great Lakes region and we'll see them for a couple weeks out of the year. That's it. For me, I feel better when I'm living in a way where I'm just really conscious of caring about the space that I occupy. And that can be like inner and outer space. It can be human and non-human kinds. It can be people. It can just like to live life through a lens of caring about things.
I kind of want to transfer now into a little bit more of the, like, the logistics of what your job looks like. And I want to start with something that is called point counting. And I think that people who maybe aren't living in the birding world, they won't know what that is.
Yeah, point counting is probably one of the most common types of bird surveying. And you'll go to a set place for a set amount of time and just record everything that you see and everything that you hear within that amount of time, and you'll visit those sites like a certain amount of times over a set period. It's a really, really good tool of just seeing what's around, when, what habitats, and also if there's like any habitat restoration processes that are going on, how well those are working based on the presence of sensitive birds that are returning or staying. I have mostly done migration counts for the last 5 years. And a migration count is like a super long, super stationary point count. The ones that I've done have ranged from 6 weeks long to 3 months long. They can be either 8 hours a day or from sunrise to sunset. And they exist to just collect data from migration season to migration season about the numbers of certain species of birds that are flying past a place, the weather conditions, because we do take weather data as well. And they're really wonderful for monitoring long-term trends.
Okay. And so I appreciate you pointing out the distinction between point counting and then what you do when you are doing migration counts. When you are doing migration counts, how do you count? And then also follow up, how do you know you aren't counting the same bird twice?
I have these things called clickers, and on days where there's just like big, big flights, we're talking like in California, I can get 100,000 birds in a day. Whitefish Point, it's going to be smaller, but in the fall for particular species, I've gotten, I think, like 30, 35,000 in a day. You have these little metal clickers that are like tally counters, and sometimes you have to count by tens. I try to count by ones as much as I can. If things are going at a crazy fast pace, I have to look up at a flock and usually estimate by fives or tens. And when I first started migration counting, I would estimate and then take a picture of that same flock that I'd estimated so I could compare and see how close I was. So I've definitely finessed my estimation skills. But the great thing about counting water birds in particular is that they have like a pretty dedicated line of travel. When hawks reach Whitefish Point, for example, they don't like water crossings. So they're going to mill and circle around, and they're really confusing to get to keep track of. I love watching them, but I'm also thankful that I'm not counting them because it's a little bit more complicated to figure out what's a new bird and what's just been circling around for the last 2 hours. Water birds, they're water birds. They don't care about Lake Superior. So they're in the spring, they're trying to get north and they fly straight past north. In the fall, they're trying to go south. So they fly straight past in the other direction. So that part is easier than it might seem, like the birds are trying to get someplace where they're not. They're going to keep going.
How has this work that you've done with migration counts, in what ways has it impacted environmental or conservation policy, maybe different designation of endangered species? Can you speak to like sort of the application of this work in a larger context?
A few years ago, a little bit more than a few years now, avian botulism really came through the Great Lakes and was impacting things like grebes and common loons, and the numbers that we were getting of those species migrating at Whitefish Point dipped too, showing that it was like a pretty widespread thing. One more specific example that I can think of is right now where I'm working in Monterey, California, there's an incredible Pacific loon flight that passes there. We'll get like 200,000 in a season, I think is the average for that count. And these birds are nesting in the high Arctic, and a lot of them are wintering in the Sea of Cortez in Baja California. And the talk of offshore wind projects in California is something that's been increasingly on certain agendas. And Pacific loons have a very dense migration. It happens at like certain weather conditions and certain seasons. It's just like this alchemy where everything has to be right to create these huge flights. But there have been 100,000 Pacific loons in like just a couple hours at Point Pinos Sea Watch, where I count. And they fly at a height that would absolutely be within the rotor sweep. And it's kind of crazy to stand out there and be seeing this beautiful loon migration, but also thinking about it in the context of what if there were like a bunch of wind turbines that were spinning and just being an avian slaughterhouse, slaughtering field. With taking the weather information and taking, like, birds will fly at different heights when there's different wind conditions, and trying to get really good data on where Pacific loons fly in relation to rotor sweep under which conditions. Offshore wind development is probably something that would be hard to stop, but perhaps with the data that we're collecting, you could shut the turbines off for those brief periods of the year when there are a lot of birds moving through, and that would be better than not doing that.
We are recording this in late winter, beginning of March. Spring is just around the corner. And I know that that means here in the Great Lakes that it's almost migration season. So I wonder if you can speak to how migration season changes your schedule as a migration counter. And yeah, in what ways it really does kind of reorient your relationship to time and endurance.
Yeah, I love the rhythms that my life takes on when I am spending a season of migration, watching and counting migration. It just has always felt a more natural rhythm to me to wake up before sunrise, start coming more alert as the world is getting light around me, and maybe have like a lull in mid-afternoon, but then be out again in evening. In spring migration, particularly, migration is a round-the-clock affair. Everything, there's just like this very limited window for these birds that are going to the far north, where once they get there, there's just a short amount of time where there's going to be enough food, enough light. Like Arctic summers are very short. And so there's just like this huge urgency to get north, and everything's in its breeding plumage and singing their territorial songs and exhibiting breeding behavior. And it's so cool to see just everything is happening all at once, and you want to see it all. So I sleep as little as possible. There's been like definitely periods of weeks where most of my sleep in migration has been like 2 to 3 hour naps in the afternoon.
Are there any species that you are looking forward to seeing during this this coming migration season?
That's the great thing about birds, is there's always something to look forward to, especially in a place like Michigan where we do have such distinct seasons. One of the first big migration events that I think we're all drawn to in this region is the sandhill crane migration. They're big birds. They fly in large flocks. They're pretty vocal. And, you know, we live in a time where birds in general aren't doing well, and I do want to draw attention to that. It's estimated that in the last half century, this continent alone has lost a third of its birds, which is not a small number. And a lot of the times, the birds that I'm keeping track of, like my numbers, it's hard to feel joyful about them. And because they're just not what they used to be. Cranes are not one of those examples at all. When the water bird count started at Whitefish Point in 1983, they would get over that 6 week period, maybe like 100 cranes over the whole period. On the peak crane migration day at Whitefish Point, since I've started doing the count, we've gotten like 5, 6, maybe even 7,000 in an 8 hour period. And so that's something that's wonderful, that they've come back and we can see them at that magnitude. I don't think it's possible to see that many cranes just following out their natural instincts and not be moved.
So in looking at regular people who might be interested in birding and maybe starting to shift their gaze upward to the trees in their neighborhood, or down if they're looking for nesting Kirtland's warblers, I wonder, what are some good things that people who are beginner birders who want to do good birding in their neighborhood, how could they get started? What should they keep in mind?
Yeah, I love this question. Like, how can somebody be a good birder? Because there's so many ways that we can be good birders. I think to me, first and foremost should be, is my seeking an experience with this bird or pursuing this bird, how is it compromising the integrity of the bird's behavior or the habitat? Like if it's something that requires trampling grass or maybe getting too close to an owl that's roosting. Owls have this just like charisma about them that I think makes people do things that are not kind to the owl, getting too close. Photographers break branches off to get a clear frame. And yeah, just like evaluating how is my experience with this bird impacting the bird. I think one thing that's really important to do is to learn like the distress signals of birds, like what postures are they taking? For example, owls, when they're stressed, if you find a roosting owl, if they're just like, they got their eyes closed and they're sort of like in a slumpy position, they're cool with you being there, like hang out and watch them. But if they get like really upright and skinny, like they're trying to hide, that's a good sign that you're too close and you should back off and give them some space. So I think that for me, the most important thing about being a good birder is being good to birds and being good to their habitat. Another thing is there are like a lot of really great new tools that have come about recently to help people identify birds. Like Merlin, for example, is an app that has been developed by Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And what it can do is just really incredible. It has like a sound detection thing that will tell you what birds are singing when you've got it running. And I think that that is a great start point. I think it's also really important to figure out how you can remember and learn those things for yourself without having to rely on a device to do it.
And you mentioned the Merlin app, and you've mentioned a couple of different bird watching groups, but I wonder if there are any other organizations or folks that you'd like to share and recommend that people can check out if they want to learn more about environmental issues related to birding and migration.
There's a few that come to mind. Audubon Great Lakes serves, it's more than just Michigan. They're based out of Chicago. They're affiliated with National Audubon, but they do a lot of really wonderful environmental justice and bird conservation work. And I think that they're definitely worth checking out the work that they do. They're really cool. American Bird Conservancy is also another organization that has a regional presence and again do like environmental justice and bird conservation work, so they're really great. As far as like bird observatories that are going to be starting their migration counts soon and are things that you can like follow along with virtually or even go up and visit, Whitefish Point Bird Observatory in the Eastern Upper Peninsula, that's a great spot. They have a hawk count and they have a water bird count. And on Friday night and Saturday night, weather permitting, people can also observe owl banding, and you can find out more about that through the Whitefish Point website. Other regional bird observatories like that are Mackinac Straits Raptor Watch, which has like great amounts of red-tailed hawks and rough-legged hawks and golden eagles, and it's up by the Mackinac Straits. And they also have people there that are happy to share the wonders of migration with anybody curious wanting to come by. There's Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory in Duluth that has another fantastic hawk migration. And then there's Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and they do a really cool migration count that they call their longshore count. And it's actually like songbirds that are migrating along the Lake Michigan shoreline. So you'll see like Baltimore Orioles and Scarlet Tanagers from the air. It's really, really cool.
You know, I think people who are doing work that is environmentally focused, environmental justice focused, there's really high burnout. And you and your adoration and love for birds, I'm wondering if there is a particular maybe like spirit bird you have that's like keeping you hopeful, or if there has been a bird that has maybe, yeah, like somehow kept you energized and really like engaged in this work in this moment, at least.
Yeah, so two examples come immediately to mind. The first is like definitely a bird that's sort of an omen for me. It's a short-eared owl. And they're not the most common species of owl. They like grasslands and marshlands, and they're pretty scarce in Michigan. But the second time that I went birding when I was 6 years old, I was fascinated with owls, as like I think we all are at one point or another. We were driving down this dirt road in southern Berrien County, and I was sitting in the back seat, and I looked up, and I saw an owl sitting in a tree, and I told my dad, I was like, hey, go back, I saw an owl. And he kept driving because he didn't believe me, it was daytime. And he's like, owls don't come out in the day. And I had been maybe like testing the boundaries with birds. I think I told him I had seen flamingos in the yard earlier that week. So he had good reason to maybe not believe me. But my mom looked back and she's like, Dave, there actually is an owl. We should back up. And he backed up, and I don't know how this bird didn't flush, because owls are usually quite flighty. And they had this ancient bird book. It's called like the Peterson Guide. It was a greenback. Some of you might be familiar with it. And we're flipping through trying to figure out what this owl was. And we're like, barred owls are sort of common in this area, but this one has yellow eyes and it doesn't have big ear tufts, so it's not a great horned owl. And it turned out to be a short-eared owl. And that was the first owl that I ever saw. And I still can't really believe it. It was probably 6 or 7 years before I saw the next one. And I oftentimes will see one at the very beginning of a count season, and maybe that will be the only one I see. And it always gives me a little reassurance that, yeah, like this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. The other bird that I absolutely love and I just like am drawn to for so many reasons is called a winter wren. And wrens in general are awesome. They just like are little and they're sassy and really, really brave and always making noise. And winter wrens are, they're like a northern forest bird. We'll have them nesting in the cedar swamps in the lower peninsula. And they'll be in like bogs and wooded areas in the UP that are wet. And they're little and they're dark and they don't like to come out totally in the open. But they just have the most beautiful song and the biggest personalities. And it's a song that like you should look up and listen to, because it's just, you can't believe that a noise that big and beautiful comes from a bird that's like less weight. You can mail a bunch of them with a postage stamp and they're just brown. And I think that there's also just like a lot that we can take from the personality of a winter wren. They're little, they're tenacious, and they've got big voices. And I think that that's something important to remember in any sort of conservation work, is you have to be determined and sometimes you have to scold, and you should make beautiful stories that a lot of people can appreciate if that's something that you're willing to do.
Waves of Change is a production of Great Lakes Now and Detroit Public Television. This digital series is produced and edited by me, Anna Seisling, with additional support from Jordan Wingrove. Great Lakes Now's executive producer is Rob Green, and Detroit Public Television's vice president of content is Ed Moore. The Winter Wren bird song you heard at the end of the interview is courtesy of Matt Medler and is archived at the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Waves of Change is brought to you by the Fred A. and Barbara M. Erb Family Foundation, the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, Richard C. Devereaux Foundation for Energy and Environmental Programs at DPTV, Polk Family Fund, DTE Energy Foundation, and listeners like you. Thank you.